Good morning. My name is David Jones. I'm a prosecutor with the 18th Judicial District. May it please the court. When the legislature enacted 18.1.3.104(5), it sent a message. That message was, if you commit a sex offense, there'll be no free passes for other offenses you commit at the same time or at the same incident as that sexual assault.
Let me jump in and interrupt you right away, because you've added at the same time to the statute. It says the same incident. And my concern with your argument, Mr. Jones, is that it seems like you're basically arguing because these occurred at the same time, they're necessarily the same incident. And I'd be interested in hearing your response to that. I don't think you would say just because they're overlapped in time, that's enough.
Well, in this case, which really brings us to the crux of the matter, Beyer and Bobrick, those are the two cases that kind of set forth the standard. And Beyer was the first in time and, for all intents and purposes, laid down the law. And it said that an occurrence, and the same incident, is an occurrence taking place as part of a larger continuum. It's a group of happenings subordinate to the main plot, a chain of events forming a part of a schematic whole. Now, what the subsequent cases said is that we can use the time frame to get a gauge as to whether or not they constitute a chain of events or a schematic whole or part of a larger continuum. So when you consider the time in the totality of these circumstances and trying to determine whether it's the same incident, same time, concurrent time, in the sense of happening in the broad scheme, that's something for the court to consider. Did they happen concurrently?
So I get that that's a factor, but what's the connection between theft and extortion and a sex offense here? I frankly, Mr. Jones, would understand it better if this was kidnapping, say, you know, or a slavery case, frankly, which is sort of, I guess, what this was alleged as, that this person took everything from this lady. You know, I can understand that better, but the theft and extortion is removed. And Beyer are different facts. I mean, Beyer, they basically shoot one guy, they put two guys in the car, they take him on a drive, and they throw him in the woods. That's very different than what happened here over a 5 or 6 year period.
With any case, with any circumstance, it's always going to be different. Beyer, Bobrick, Lempool, Cordova, none of those are going to have the same facts that line up and are directly on point. The question here is, what is it more like? And you mentioned the slavery situation. This wasn't like a slavery. We didn't allege it was like a slavery. We're alleging, and we did allege, that it was, for all intents and purposes, slavery that occurred here. Now, the jury found false imprisonment. It's difficult to separate false imprisonment and using money and travel documents to coerce the victim to stay. It's hard to distinguish that from physical force and keeping that person locked in a house. For all intents and purposes, the victim in this case was locked to that home and was only allowed to move about this country, this city, at the beck and call of the defendant and his wife. So here you say that they're very different facts from Beyer, but really they're not. They're very interrelated. The theft and extortion were necessary for the defendant to have continuing access to the victim to perpetrate his sexual contact violations. His sexual contact violations occur over the course of 12 months.
Can you talk about the evidence? I appreciate the point you're making here, Mr. Jones. Can you talk about the evidence? You said they were necessary. I guess I wasn't so clear from your brief as to why. Okay. Could you be very specific? Tell me why.
In 2002, the victim in this case was brought over from Saudi Arabia. She's originally an Indonesian national. She was employed by Mr. Al Turki. Mr. Al Turki moved to the United States and brought her with him. He obtained for her a passport, and he signed an employment contract with her, whereby she would be paid 600 reals per month to be a housekeeper, a nanny, essentially a do-it-all for the family. She was brought over. She didn't speak English. The passport and travel documents that were obtained for her to be in this country were maintained and held by Mr. El Turki. And the time period for which she was allowed to be in this country was allowed to expire by Mr. El Turki. Someone who is fluent in English, someone who knows the customs, the cultures, and the laws of this country, whereas the victim in this case didn't. She couldn't speak English. She didn't know the laws. She was young and didn't have any access to friends or family. She was, for all intents and purposes, locked to the home of the El Turkis because she couldn't move freely about this country. And when he began to perpetrate his sex crimes, she was not in a position to be able to extricate herself to escape from Mr. El Turki because he possessed her travel documents. She had no money because he never paid her. She was his slave.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Jones. I'd like to change the subject a little bit. As I review the record, this is the first time in the 35A motion that the prosecution has raised this. And in fact, the prosecution has previously taken a different position. At the first sentencing, the prosecutor said that the theft conviction could be run concurrently with the other counts because the conduct described in connection with the theft conviction was substantially different from the conduct of the unlawful sexual contact. And the same point was made about the extortion conviction. It didn't need to be consecutive, but it does not need to be concurrent. And although it does relate to some degree to the theft, it clearly, my own emphasis, had no direct relation to the sexual assault counts. What are we to do with that prior statement, which is a different argument than you're making now?
Nothing. That's the simple answer, is you're to do nothing with that statement. Because unlike an appeal of a trial where objections must be tendered, otherwise you're facing different standards, what we're dealing with here is an illegal sentence. It's an illegal sentence at its inception. So there's a jurisdictional issue. The prosecution, in
well,
any sense,
let's test whether it is indeed an illegal sentence at its inception. I understand what the statute says, but this is not the sort of illegal sentence where on its very face you look at it and say, ah, this is a speeding case, and the court has ordered that the defendant spend 20 years in prison. That is clearly beyond the structure of the statute. Here, all the numbers are within the statutory limits. The argument is simply concurrent or consecutive, but that isn't triggered until the issue is brought to the court. And the issue wasn't brought to the court at the first sentencing hearing by the prosecution. The issue wasn't brought to the court by the prosecution at the second sentencing hearing. It was only brought subsequently. Am I wrong about that?
You're right about everything but the triggered part. The statute speaks for itself. The prosecution isn't responsible for making sure that the court follows the law. I agree with you, the prosecution was wrong or was ignorant of the law. And as a matter of fact, so was the court. But the bottom line is that when the prosecution becomes aware of an illegal sentence, they can bring that to the court's attention and seek correction because it's a jurisdictional issue.
And I understand that's your argument. But I guess my question is, is it truly an illegal sentence when a court has to make some findings, factual findings, and then a legal conclusion, i.e., I see the following facts and I make the conclusion that this arose from the same incident? This, again, is not triggered by the standard sorts of sentencing limits. I mean, this is something that the court has to make findings about because it's not automatically imposed. For example, if we had a case where everyone would agree that the theft and extortion were not connected in any way to the sex assaults, we wouldn't be here. So the court has some role here, and no one asked the court to fulfill that function.
The statute told the court to fulfill that function. Again, this is not a situation of being triggered by any specific event. The statute lays out the law. The court's authority is provided by the General Assembly. And if it doesn't follow that law, it participates in the execution of an illegal sentence.
And so you don't think that the prosecution should be held to its prior position here?
No, because it is an illegal sentence. It's just like the prosecution entering into a plea disposition that is illegal. That can be the illegality of that sentence can be raised by either the prosecution or the defendant. It doesn't matter that they both participated in the execution of that plea agreement, which was illegal. In fact, they actually asked the court to impose that illegal sentence jointly. And they can still ask the court to vacate that illegal sentence under 35A. Because an illegal sentence, in and of itself, is a jurisdictional issue. The court is in a position where it really must correct the illegal sentence, or it's subject to reversal by the Court of Appeals. Now, the rule says may, and that's accurate. The court may correct the illegal sentence, or it may not. But if it doesn't, it's going to be overturned by the Court of Appeals. That illegal sentence, under any circumstances, is still illegal. Now, 35A distinguishes and is now clearer than it was when we were dealing with the cases cited by defense. Bobrick and, at the moment I'm not remembering the case name, but the cases cited by defense dealt with an earlier version of 35A. And there it simply said illegal sentence. An illegal sentence may be reversed at any time. The Supreme Court changed that rule and made it clearer. The rule now says the court may correct a sentence that was not authorized by law or that was imposed without jurisdiction at any time. Clarifying for both the district courts and the appellate courts what is meant by in a legal manner, which is the subsequent part of the rule. Illegal manner has been clarified by People versus Bowerman, and it's the type of thing where you're dealing with the right of allocution. Did you give the defendant the right of allocution? Did you fail to consider factors established by statute when you imposed the sentence? Did the defendant receive testing that was required before sentencing, like, for example, in a sex offense? Those are the imposed in illegal manner circumstances. Here, we fall under the not authorized by law or imposed without jurisdiction. It can be raised at any time because it's always going to be illegal, and it's illegal at its inception. The court is beyond its authority, and as such, that sentence must be reversed and sentenced according to the law. Parties can't stipulate to an illegal sentence. So the prosecution's acquiescence in this case on that first sentencing to the establishment that, well, this is not part of the same thing, it doesn't matter. A legal conclusion was made here. Now, if I could have a moment. I cite that in my brief, that the legal or the factual statements or conclusions made by the court were made in 2006 and 2011. Those factual statements can only lead to one conclusion, that this was the part of the same incident. Specifically, the court said, the victim was required to perform long hours of domestic services with minimum wages, little time off and no vacations, other than when she was accompanied by the El Turkey family on their family vacations. During this time, she was essentially confined to the defendant's home, and the evidence at trial showed that she was repeatedly and forcibly subjected to unwanted sexual contact. That's the factual finding made by the court. Another one in 2011.
Pardon me again, Mr. Jones, if I may.
Sure.
But the court said more than that, didn't it? For example, when talking about extortion, the court said the threats that Mr. Alturki made were part of his efforts to obtain the victim's domestic services without the agreed and fair payment. They are essentially part of the theft of those services, and the threats, the court believes, were a mechanism employed by the defendant to obtain those services without the agreed and fair payment. There's no reference to any sexual offense in that paragraph I just read to you.
There isn't, but we're talking about a chain of events. And
but there's no suggestion of a relationship. Am I wrong?
In that paragraph, that's correct. But this paragraph, where he makes the complete record as far as the connection between all of the crimes, there he was only dealing with the two. He said nothing about the sex offense in that paragraph. He addressed it not at all. But he does in this paragraph, and he also addresses the extortion and the theft. He made the factual findings that made the connection, the chain, the schematic hole. That schematic hole is that he used those travel documents, he used the fact that she was without any money to keep her there so that he could perpetrate his sex offenses again on her. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Norman Mueller. With me at council table is co-counsel Hal Haddon. I think the questions of the court from Judges Bernard and Judge Gabriel indicate and sort of summarize our position. From the beginning, this case was tried as that these were separate and distinct offenses. Judge Bernard, you already quoted from the original sentencing hearing. At the resentencing hearing, when the district attorney was arguing that there was a possibility of consecutive sentences at the discretion of the court, the district attorney clearly conceded that theft and extortion were separate and distinct offenses. What the district attorney did not do, because the district attorney cannot do, is cite to portions of the record to show that, in fact, these are part of the same incident. This case was tried under the theory that the theft and the extortion were really more related to Mr. Alturki's wife. Mr. Alturki's wife was the one who kept the books on the wages. Mr. Alturki's wife was the one who sort of, with whom S.A. dealt in terms of should there be any payments. There were partial payments. The contract did not provide for when payments should be made. S.A. stayed in Saudi Arabia after the Alturkis came to the United States. She worked for a sister of Mrs. Well, it isn't Mrs. Alturki, it's Miss, I've forgotten her last name, but Mr. Alturki's wife. When she came here, after the Alturki family had already been here, there were partial payments, and so the evidence was contested as to what was the expectation. This case was defended, if the court looks at the theory of the defense instruction, that the theft charge was defended on the theory that this was a cultural difference. This was the way Saudi Arabia deals with domestic help. They maintain the money, and then they pay at the end of the service. And that's what happened when S.A. was in Saudi Arabia. She was paid at the end of that short period of time, and then when she stayed with the sister of Mr. Alturki's wife, she was paid at the end of that service before she came here. And I think the questions of the court and what Judge Hannon found are precisely on point, that these really were separate incidents.
Mr. Mueller, yes. If I may interrupt you, I asked Mr. Jones about inconsistent prior positions, and to be fair, I have to ask you about an inconsistent prior position that the defense took in this case at the first sentencing hearing. Then defense counsel is the one who referred to 18.1.3 10045. and then defense counsel said, if anything, that statute requires that the sex offenses be run consecutive with the extortion conviction and the theft conviction. That's our view of the law. I think it's pretty clear what the General Assembly has said. It may be required under the statute that those sex offenses, assuming that they are all concurrent, be consecutive with the other non-sex crimes. I asked Mr. Jones what we are to do with the prosecution statements. I ask you, what are we to do with the defense statements?
Well, Mr. Isciano did make that statement, but I believe it is not inconsistent. What Mr. Isciano was doing was, I think, perhaps not as clearly as he should have, but he was arguing, basically, Judge, if you're going to impose any consecutive sentences, you certainly have the discretion to do it for the theft and extortion. I think he was arguing, and I don't have a clear recollection if he went this far, that theft and extortion themselves must be concurrent because they are related. Because as I think was pointed out by one of the questions or one of the quotes, the theory of the prosecution was not that theft at trial, was not that theft and extortion had to do with the sex offenses, the charged sex offenses. It had to do with maintaining her services until Mr. Alturki completed his PhD and went back to Saudi Arabia. It was separate and apart. I think what Mr. Isciano was doing, and again, I think it was not as clear as it should have been, was saying, Judge, we concede that in all of these events, you have discretion to impose consecutive sentences. The district attorney argued at trial that the sex offenses were separate and distinct offenses. They were charged on a month-by-month basis. They argue and they concede in their brief here, I think it was page 10 of their reply brief, that the sex offenses are separate and distinct. So if the sex offenses are all separate and distinct, if they are all separated by time and intervening events, which they are, how can all of them be the same incident as the theft and extortion? They can't be. And that's why the district attorney conceded at the original sentencing and the second sentencing that these were indeed separate and distinct offenses. And that's where I think when Beyer was the first case that sort of added gave the definition of what same incident meant, and it was relying on the dictionary definition, and it expanded from what the defense was arguing, as I recall, which was it's a separate unit of experience. And the division in Beyer said, no, it's a little bit broader than that. But what they said was it has to be part of a continuum, part of a chain of events. It cannot be broken. And in Bobrick, when it was discussed in more detail, that definition, if it said it cannot be, the same incident cannot be separated by time or by intervening events. We had 4-year period of time charged in the theft and extortion. Yes, there was an overlapping period of time, but just because one offense occurs in overlapping a period of time with another offense does not make it part of the same incident. There were intervening time frames and there were intervening events. What is to be done with the fact that every summer that the Alturki family was in the United States, they went back to Saudi Arabia? And SA stayed here and went to Kansas, went to another state. That seems to me to be an intervening event. So we think Judge Hannon, who was the trial judge, who sat through this and made the findings of fact, and that's what this is. There is no legal conclusion about what does the statute mean. What does the statute mean? Judge Hannon knows what it means. We all know what it means. There may be some difference about what is the exact definition of same incident, but that is a factual determination. And Lenk rule says that, in fact, that's a factual determination made by the trial judge. And this trial judge who sat through the trial said this is not the same incident. This is a legal sentence, and if it's this appeal is not dismissed for the reasons I've said in my brief, the judgment should be affirmed.
Can I ask you, do we look at the evidence that came in, the charges that were brought, or both? in trying to decide if it was the same incident?
Well, I think it has to be the, I think it's both, but at the end of the day, it has to be with the evidence. It has to be, does this evidence establish that it was part of the same incident? And that's what's missing from the district attorney's brief. I mean, is there any evidence, because there's not, that SA said, oh yes, Mr. Albuquerque promised to pay my wages if I submitted to sexual contact. Well, she claimed she didn't submit. So there is no such evidence. And it really is, this is, if this case is all, if these charges are all part of the same incident, there are no limits. And we're going to be into the land of mandatory consecutive sentences anytime any other offense is charged with a sex offense.
Let me, if I can explore that just briefly, sure. As my questions to Mr. Jones may have been clear, I'm trying to figure out where the line is myself. What in this case, give you a hypothetical. Let's say Judge Hannon said, I think the evidence here shows this was a slavery situation, and this guy basically took everything from this woman. Would he have been, in your view, within his authority then to say, I think that arises out of the same incident? So we've got basically finds as a fact, I think this was basically slavery, and then he committed theft and extortion. Is that enough?
Well, I think it would have been a clearly erroneous finding of fact. I mean, I do...
I understand.
Yeah.
But just take that hypothetical.
Well,
if that was a fact.
Yeah, I believe it would have been clearly erroneous, and I don't think that it was justified under the facts of this case. I don't think you can expand. Same incident is meant to be a court always has discretionary power to impose consecutive sentences when there are separate and distinct offenses not supported by the same evidence. This statute was meant to be to apply to situations which, for example, in Bobrick, where, as you pointed out, Your Honor, the incident happened, they were shot, they were removed, it was a part of a continuing episode. Look at, I think it was Cordova, which is the, I may be mixing up my name of cases, but I think it was Cordova, in which there was a burglary and a followed by binding one of the victims. They were threatened, a car was stolen, the victim was put in the car, and then the sexual assault occurred. One continuing set of events with no intervening circumstances. It's very hard to answer your question hypothetically or generically because I'm not sure what slavery means. I mean, there certainly could be a situation I could envision where there might be another offense that occurred as part of a kidnapping, if that had been proven, which it wasn't in this case. The jury rejected that.
Mr. Mueller, let me ask you, the theft and the extortion were over a four-year period, and the sexual assault was 8 to 10 months.
It was a 12-month period.
12-month.
Yes. Yes, they charged the sex offenses, they charged sexual assault, and there was very explicit testimony from the accuser, S.A., that, you know, she had been subjected to sexual assault, not sexual contact, and the jury rejected the sexual assault charges, but they were charged month by month with leading off the two summer months that the Albuquerque family was gone back to Saudi Arabia. So there were, it was a month by month over a little over a year period. I mean, maybe in a 13-month period. And you're right, Judge Plank, the theft and extortion, the theft was over a four-year period. And if I'm remembering right, the extortion was charged over maybe a two-year period. If there are no other questions, again, we'd ask the court to affirm the judgment of Judge Hannon.
Counsel, thank you for your oral arguments today. We appreciate them. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. Please drive safely home. And the bailiff may announce the recess.